As dawn breaks, we are close to Vienna. However, the train can't get in, and it's lunchtime when we pull into the station and can get off. The train is needed for taking frontline replacements, we are told. At the station master's office, I meet up with an Unteroffizier from our 26th Armoured Regiment, who, just like me, is returning from leave and is going to the same place as I am. We discover that our units are still in the same area as before. We wait until evening before we can travel on. It takes another 2 days before we reach our destination, having to change trains several times. 6th of June. Our regiments are next to each other, around Yasimonesht. Heavy losses in the last few months and weeks have meant that they have had to be reorganized into combat groups. The Unteroffizier is whisked away very quickly in a vehicle to his regiment, and shortly afterwards I'm able to hitch a ride with a supply truck from our battalion to our Schwadron. As we part company, we agree to keep in contact from time to time. Unfortunately, nothing will come of it. This would be the only time we were to meet, and like so many other meetings that have taken place during the war, they remain only for a brief period, although I often reflect on them. 8th of June. This morning I reached my Schwadron by means of a supply truck from the battalion. In the orderly room, I noticed straight away that Unteroffizier Totenhaupt, Turnip, is missing, nor is the Spieß present. An Obergefreiter, whom I don't know, tells me that Totenhaupt was wounded in an aerial attack 2 weeks ago while he was in his vehicle, and ended up in hospital. I meet up with Fritz Hamann and Varias, the tall chap, in our quarters, and they're delighted to see me again. A lot has happened in the Schwadron. Some of the news surprises and amazes me, and some of it touches me painfully. Two of the worst pieces of news are that Clem fell last week and that the professor lost his right arm to a grenade splinter, causing him to bleed to death. Gefreiter Halbach, who had not been with us for very long, is reported to have been so seriously wounded that he will probably not make it. These bad tidings remind me once again how terrible the war is here on the front. I can't see Gustav Koller, so I ask after him, and I learn something surprising. Both of them let me wait for a moment, then Fritz blurts out, "Gustav got the Knight's Cross!" "What? What did he get it for? What happened?" "Not much more than what normally happens in our attacks," Fritz tells me, "the only difference being that our dear Gustav, who in your absence took over the command of the machine guns, lost contact with the rifle platoons to the left of us. We continued following his lead further into the little forest. As I and my assistant gunner were almost out of it the other end, 3 T-34s were standing in the edge of the forest with their crews outside. They were talking in an agitated manner with an officer. We immediately brought both machine guns into position among the trees, and Gustav and I fired on the Russians. Two died right away, and the rest we took prisoner. After one of our men guarded the prisoners, we realized that the tanks were securing the Russians' flank, and that even an artillery observer with a communications link was there, connecting up the Russian crossfire. What happened then was a real party. We were able to fire into the trenches from the edge of the forest just as hard as we could. So the attack by our lot, which had been stopped, could get moving again, and our regiment could roll up the Russian trenches with very few losses on our side. That was about all there was to it. Well, at least all there was to report. As a result of the three captured tanks and the firing into the trenches, Gustav received the Knight's Cross, and Varias and I got the Iron Cross first class. Hey, that was great. I was happy. But actually, it was an accident because, well, Gustav lost the connection, right? Right, confirms Varias. But no one asks questions afterwards. It's results that count. Where is Gustav now? No idea. Since he came to the regimental headquarters yesterday to get his Knight's Cross, no one's heard of him. They say he was promoted to Unteroffizier and will have to go on a course. Nothing more has been heard about him. To my great regret, I would never see Gustav again. We all know how it is when a fellow is awarded the Knight's Cross. He is no longer his old self, but becomes a sort of celebrity, to be paraded around all over the place. I knew Gustav, and I don't believe he will have felt particularly happy being shown off as some big hero. He knew full well that he was no more a daredevil than any of the rest of us. As Fritz Hamann says, they did the right thing when they lost the connection to the rifle platoons. They did the right thing when they fired at the tank crew before they could get back into their tank and blow them to kingdom come. Then they had the good fortune to find themselves right on the flank of the enemy so that they could fire into them, and thus enable the regiment to take the enemy positions while suffering only minor casualties. Poor Gustav. When those at the top have used you enough for their purposes as a shining example of a soldier hero, you will certainly be sent right back to the front lines. But your chances of surviving this time will be greatly diminished compared with before, because all your superior officers will use you as a hero precisely there, where the action is hottest and where they can get the most out of you. That is perhaps why, in the end, only a handful of ordinary soldiers survive their awards of the Knight's Cross. Gustav Koller didn't survive. Just months later, I would learn of his fate, when, after my serious injury, I am for some weeks assigned temporary duty training recruits. Quite by coincidence, I meet up with an Obergefreiter who had been with Gustav in combat in Hungary. He tells me that Sergeant Koller was part of every suicide squad, and on the 10th of November 1944 he was killed with his men while storming an enemy position. Poor devil. Your glory with the Knight's Cross lasted only a few months, until fate decided that the proud Knight's Cross should be converted into a simple wooden cross. All that remains are the memories of a good friend and treasured comrade, who accidentally became a hero, and possibly, therefore, had to die sooner than those who fought on without getting any official recognition. Chapter 14. Condemned to Death. It is the 9th of June, and I am back in action once more. Aerial reconnaissance has reportedly found a large number of Soviet tanks in an assembly area. The assumption that the Soviets are starting a large offensive does not prove correct, however, and we are involved only in some minor combats, which result in two wounded. 15th of June. Today we are between Yassy and Targu Frumos, dug in on high ground, with good observation over a flat green area. Behind us, several farm buildings are burning, set ablaze by enemy mortar fire. The wind often blows black smoke into our faces. It has a terrible smell and interferes with our breathing. The houses have long been evacuated by their owners, but when they went, they didn't always have time to get the cattle out of the buildings and to take them along. If the creatures didn't die from starvation, they will have been killed by the shelling or by the fires. Carcasses are lying all over the place, in various stages of decay, giving off a horrible stench. 16th of June. After the onset of darkness, we notice enemy movements on the wide, flat expanse in front of us. The expected attack has still not materialized, but we are bombarded throughout the night with high explosive shells. The enemy can see where we are because we are silhouetted against the flames constantly rising up behind us. 17th of June. In the grey of the dawn there is a dense fog, which appears to be slowly moving towards us, driven by the wind. I've never seen it like this. It may be that the enemy is taking advantage of this morning fog and moving towards us under its cover. The milky wall of fog is approaching us and seems to get even thicker. Then, through my sight, I spot what appears to be the outline of a bent figure, with what looks like a kit bag or something on his back. I take aim, and at a range of at least a kilometer, I fire a short burst at it. The effect is so amazing that we all burst out laughing. Ivan must have been carrying smoke grenades, which apparently also caused the fog. Immediately after I fire, a great cloud of white smoke comes out of his kit bag. He, in turn, instead of getting rid of it, races away, zigzagging as if somebody is chasing him. Eventually, all the smoke grenades in his kit bag go off, and it looks for all the world as if he is rocket-propelled. Immediately we open up with our heavy weapons into the fog, and halt the enemy attack before it even gets underway. As the fog clears, large numbers of bodies and several mortars and other weapons are spread out on the field below us. 20th of June. Although the action over these days is primarily defensive in nature, we do suffer a number of dead and several wounded. Among the latter is our Ober, in charge once more of our depleted Schwadron. No one knows for certain how many times he's really been wounded. He was wearing the gold wounded badge, which you get after 5 injuries, at the bridgehead at Nikopol. If he suffered only minor injuries, he always stayed at headquarters to convalesce, but this time his injuries seem to be more serious, and he will therefore have to be taken to the regimental medical station, and later probably transferred to a military hospital back home. 27th of June. The regiment was taken off frontline duty on the 21st of June, and now we're at a rest area near Popesht. Despite the fact that we are talking about a regiment, our actual combat strength is only equivalent to 2 Schwadronen. Besides 1 Unteroffizier, there are now only 7 men left of the original force which made up our Schwadron. Even among the replacements which have come to us from time to time, very few are now left, since many have been killed or wounded. So we are now being replenished with new recruits from Insterburg. We've got a mixed bag of young and old men, among whom are many East Europeans of German ethnic background, and also a lot of Russian volunteers. Instead of rearming us with urgently needed weapons, they want to bolster our strength with hastily trained cannon fodder. It's madness. 14th of July. A couple of rumours are circulating. One says that our unit is supposed to be going to East Prussia to secure our border there. We ask ourselves if the government, and that means Hitler, really believes that the enemy will soon be there. It is also said that so-called Volksgrenadiere have been assembled in order to increase the fighting power of the unit. We have no idea what kind of units these are supposed to be. Many soldiers are joking about it, suggesting that this would mean that our grandfathers are being called up as the last reserve. Some of the newcomers who have arrived over the recent few days are talking about a new revenge weapon which is about to be deployed. We wonder when this is supposed to take place, when our cities have been flattened and occupied by the enemy. I'd heard about this wonder weapon during my leave, and I reckon it's a rumour put about to give the population new hope. 15th of July. Some days ago we were assigned a lieutenant as our new Schwadron's chef. I can't even begin to count how many officers we have had since October 1943. He doesn't seem too bad, but he doesn't have the gift of imparting to the Schwadron the feeling of belonging and comradeship that is necessary. Somehow something is missing, something we old hands can feel. Too many new faces have come along, and we have to get used to them. We old-timers have formed our own clique. The newcomers admire us for our decorations and for our long experience of the front line, but we don't warm to them. It's the same with the new leaders. They don't know us, and they can't judge us correctly, and so they don't know how best to deploy us to the unit's advantage. We'll have to wait and see when we are back on the line. On the front line, when you're dependent on one another, the feeling of unity and comradeship comes about almost by itself. 18th of July. The rest and relaxation period is over. We drive to Roman and then march the rest of the way to entrain. We are actually destined for East Prussia, though en route our orders are changed and we're redirected to Poland. The Soviets are said to have crossed the River Bug and are marching west. 20th of July. There has been an attempt on Hitler's life. None of us know anything about the reasons for this. There is talk of a conspiracy among high-ranking officers who are now going to be executed. We are also surprised to learn that from now on, instead of the normal military salute, we must use the German salute with the outstretched hand, just like the SS, we think. But orders are orders. I don't really think this ruling will do anything to improve esprit de corps. On the contrary, we're wondering why they think they ought to move us soldiers closer to the party bigwigs. Anyway, they are hangers-on, and we shall find ways of taking care of them. They're supposed to have assigned political officers even on the staffs, and they are to bring us, the fighting men, closer to National Socialist ideals. What utter nonsense! As if it will help us survive. Thank goodness I've never met up with this type face to face. Anyway, I doubt they'd have the guts to join us in the trenches. 21st of July. We're in Poland, given the mission to hold the front line near Yaroslav on the River San. The enemy has already tried to cross the river at several points. During day one, we meet up with German troops cut off from their own units, generally panic-stricken and wandering aimlessly around in the lowlands along the banks of the river. They tell us that many of their comrades have been shot by Polish partisans. During the night, we are involved in heavy fighting and manage to prevent the enemy from crossing the river. 25th of July. While it is still dark, a formation of tanks with mounted infantry launches an attack. We have no anti-tank weapons and have to evacuate our positions. Everyone runs back in panic, seeking protection in a cornfield. The tanks chase us and overtake us. The mounted Soviets attack, and many of us are killed in hand-to-hand fighting. Varias and I manage to hide under some straw that hasn't been flattened by the rain. Because of the dark, we are very lucky and don't get discovered. After an hour, as some of the tanks have been destroyed and the enemy is again forced back, we risk pulling out of the cornfield. Nothing has happened to us, and we have even been able to save our heavy machine gun. It's been a bloody day, with heavy losses. Many of the men have been butchered in close combat with enemy infantry. They lie there with crushed heads and slit stomachs. Many have been flattened by the tanks. Since our flight through the cornfield, our commander, the Leutnant, has gone missing. He was last seen with a tank catching him in the field, and he was running back with some soldiers. No one knows whether he is wounded, was killed, or fell into enemy hands. Judging by the massacre, the enemy hasn't taken any prisoners. The word missing gives hopes to families, although people who have experienced the war in Russia wouldn't give a farthing for such a hope. Such is the pent-up hatred of the enemy that anyone who falls into their hands doesn't have a chance of surviving, and any hope melts like snow in the spring sunshine. Even though we didn't know our Leutnant well, we regret his loss very much. He may have had only limited experience, but he had a strong sense of duty and was an exemplary officer. Fritz Hamann lost his assistant gunner and with him also the mounting for the heavy machine gun. Now the only operational HMG is my one. 26th of July. An Oberleutnant has been appointed as our new Schwadronschef, and he is taking over our small band and the remains of the 7th Squadron. The enemy keeps attacking our position near Volopelkinska. Our losses mount steadily, and the number of dead rises and rises. Between the firefights, we're told that our new chef has also fallen. The speed with which blossoming human life is snuffed out is an indication of how hard and terrible the fighting is. And it gets even worse. One leader relieves another. All through this savage butchery, the new men in our Schwadron become more and more anxious. They are only fighting because of the sense of duty which has been drummed into them. When there is fighting, more and more of them only go forward reluctantly, trying to stay back under cover for as long as possible. If I need more ammunition while fighting is going on, I often have to yell my head off because the ammo carriers are sitting in some foxhole or other and daren't come up front to us. As a result, Varias or I have to run back to the rear ourselves in order to get it. Our carriers, some of them volunteers, claim they haven't heard our calls because of the racket going on. So we're in even greater danger, and the outcome is that not long afterwards, my old pal Varias gets wounded in the shoulder and has to be evacuated to the medical facility. Now Varias isn't here, I am definitely missing something. A great feeling of despondency has come over me, and I'd love to crawl into a hole somewhere. But I sense that my resignation has caused a further lowering of morale in our replacements, since they look upon us old hands as the fearless, combat-experienced men. I therefore feel obliged to give at least the outward impression of a brave soldier. I am helped in this by my routine attitude and my somewhat stubborn commitment during combat. 27th of July. The enemy has crossed the River Wisłok in the north with strong forces and is fighting his way forward. We're trying to hold him back between Landshut and Reichshof, but we only partly succeed. My new number two is Obergefreiter Dochka, who was formerly with the 7th Schwadron. Dochka is an old-timer who, having convalesced after getting wounded at the Nikopol bridgehead, was returned to his Shvadron in Romania. After a heavy day of fighting, we pull into quarters in Reichshof, where we are again reorganized. No one knows any longer what belongs to whom. The rest of the Shvadron is revamped and forms a kind of battle group led by a battalion staff, and we get a trickle of men from the replacement depot in Insterburg. To my delight, Valdi reappears among these replacements. He has been on an NCO course and now wears the appropriate silver braid. He was assigned somewhere else to begin with, but he has managed to get transferred to become our section leader. He's surprised to find that Fritz Hamann and I are still here, but is delighted to be with us again. He tells us that our Oberleutnant, the Prince, had supposedly submitted the paperwork for us to be awarded the next highest medal, but after his death this had not been sent on by the Spieß. Turnip told him this when they were together in the convalescent unit. We knew nothing of this, but we weren't particularly surprised. We know how these things go, and realize it always depends on the individual judgment of a superior. What makes the difference, and Fritz thinks like I do, is that our most fervent wish is that we can survive this damned war. We've made it so far, and with God's help we can make it to the end. Unfortunately, this piece of luck was not granted our good comrade Valdi. 28th of July. Valdi has changed a lot. Now that he wears braid, he has more responsibility and has to set a good example for the new men. But he doesn't. He's nervous and apprehensive, and although he tries to hide it from others, he can't hide it from me. I can see the problem. He's been away from this murderous war for too long, and he has to get used to it all over again, used to the fact that death is all around us, but we nevertheless can't bury our heads in the sand. Once, when we were attacking through a forest where the enemy had dug in, Valdi was nowhere to be seen. We had to pull back because of heavy counterfire, and I found him taking cover in the same place he was before the attack. Thinking about this, I believe that Valdi had sensed in his subconscious that something awful was about to happen. Some days later, when we had organized a few bottles of brandy from a local distillery and emptied them after the fighting, he made some very strange remarks, which at the time I interpreted as just a few sentimental comments made under the influence. He talked a good deal about his friend Fritz Koschinski, who had been killed during the battle for the Nikopol bridgehead. He also talked about the death of his grandmother, and claimed to have heard the tolling of her funeral bell, although she had been dead for a long time. This conversation came back to me the next morning, when I had to witness Valdi being caught by a burst of enemy machine gun fire, and falling dead to the ground. A young relative of our earlier commander, a young prince too, also fell for Führer, Volk und Vaterland, as it is so nicely worded in the obituary notice. 5th of August. This evening we were relieved by another unit, and drove for the remainder of the night. In the morning we occupied a house at the Strutchin bridgehead, and we've spent the entire day resting up. There is everything that a soldier's heart desires in the many supply depots in Galicia. We are living like the proverbial maggots in the bacon. Ammunition, which has been in short supply, is now available and we can stock up, and even a unit equipped with the so-called stovepipes for close-range anti-tank use can now be resupplied. 6th of August. Today my state of mind has sunk to zero level. I genuinely believe that I'd become strong enough to be able to eliminate all thoughts of anything threatening or unpleasant, but that plainly is not the case. As if something is driving me, I have to think about all the friends who have died beside me, and to recognize that, among a very few, I am still alive. I am convinced that God has heard my prayers, but then I also know that others also prayed, and in spite of that, perished. What is the secret and the purpose that might explain why God decides upon different fates? 7th of August. Even mere survival at the front is difficult, and it can be traumatic. It cannot be denied that a survivor's nerves can slowly become brittle. I have also become restless and apprehensive, and I have the feeling that it will soon be Fritz's and my turn. The war at the front line doesn't allow anyone to escape, and in the uncertainty of the situation, the many new faces around me and the constant changes in leadership make me even more insecure and fearful. Beyond that, I am of the opinion that our leaders are no longer able to do anything about the enemy's enormous capabilities. It follows, therefore, that all that is happening is a series of fruitless attempts to plug the holes in our defences where the enemy has broken through, not with more weapons, but with human beings, something which for the average soldier is tantamount to a death sentence. Although today, as usual, I'm trying to keep my mind on the enemy situation and on my upcoming engagement, I can't deny that within me an inexplicable fear is rising like a heat wave, creating nervous unrest throughout my entire being. I can't rid myself from this feeling that something terrible is about to happen to me. It has taken root in my brain so strongly that I believe it's a kind of premonition. When I think back, I have always experienced this restlessness before being injured, and it was not until I had healed that I regained my composure. This time, however, the feeling I choose to call a premonition is stronger than ever before. I am therefore thankful when orders come to mount up, because it takes my mind off things. Our unit is to be transferred to another sector with all available vehicles. Just before we get to a village, we have to secure an embankment sloping down to the Vistula. There is no sign of the enemy, but we know that he's already tried to cross it at various places. Stretching from the edge of the village down to the Vistula is a harvested cornfield, and at the edge this drops down for a short distance to the river. The farmer has not apparently had time to gather in all the sheaves. Most of them are still lying on the field, and they serve as camouflage for our positions, which are on the upper ridge of a hollow. In front of the field of stubble is a narrow band of meadowland, bordered by bushes, some trees, and a small wood. The river itself lies beyond this copse, and cannot be seen from where we are. Following orders, we position ourselves in front of the village and begin to dig our foxhole. The ground is hard and dry from the sun. It's a hot August day, and the sun is baking our hides. In spite of heavy perspiration, the digging is no problem for Obergefreiter Dorker, my assistant gunner, and myself. I have mentioned once before that Willy Dorker and I have already dug hundreds of foxholes in the ground. But now we nearly throw up our last cup of coffee when an Unteroffizier comes over and tells us that an officer has given orders that we are to move our heavy machine gun further to the front in the sloping cornfield. We can't believe we've heard him properly. Why should we exchange a position with a great field of fire and good protection for one which is easy for the enemy to spot? Whoever gives these kinds of orders can't, God knows, have much in the way of front-line experience. The Unteroffizier is also unhappy. He is supposed to position himself in the field off to the right with his light machine gun. With gritted teeth, we begin to dig our new hole. Sweat runs out of our buttonholes, but deep in the earth it is moist and cool. After we have made our hole, we camouflage it with sheaves of corn and disappear into the depths. As it gets dark, restlessness overtakes me. As a rule, we relieve each other from watch every 2 hours, but today I will probably not be able to sleep, so I take the first shift right away and will only wake Dorka when it is necessary. A gentle night breeze wafts over from the Vistula, and at first I find it quite pleasant. There are no clouds in the sky, and the stars are glittering under a deep blue canopy. The smell of newly harvested corn rises from the field and is heavy in the air. The smell awakens memories. I am reminded of home and the enjoyable, albeit brief time, of time spent on harvesting duty with my girlfriend Tardel. She was a real farmer's daughter, and once told me that the corn was for her the symbol of growth, development, and fulfillment. I know what she meant, but at the moment I'm oppressed by the smell of the ripe corn mixed with the rather mouldy reeds from the Vistula riverbank, which the wind wafts over to us. Slowly a milky fog from the riverbank creeps through the forest across the meadow and up to us. After a time it grows thicker, and the suffocating vapours float back and forth like ghostly beings in the wind. I peer into the fog and jump at each insignificant little noise. Field mice, no doubt, moving around in a sheaf of corn, just busy running about. Still, a restless feeling remains in me. As a matter of fact, the restlessness increases when I realize that we're alone in front of the cornfield without anyone to the side of us. Even the other machine gun with the sergeant is somewhat behind us. The fog creeps slowly higher up towards us, and now it's so thick that we can only see the outlines of the village. The moisture deposits itself on the machine gun and makes me feel chilly. I turn up my collar and squat deeper into the foxhole. We have covered the bottom of the hole with straw. Dochka is sitting curled up in one corner with his back leaning up against the wall. He is breathing deeply, and I can hear him quietly snoring. I'll let him sleep, even though he should have relieved me from my watch long ago. I'll wake him up when I feel tired. As I am about to cover the machine gun with a canvas because of the damp, I clearly hear squeaking noises and also voices in the fog. The Russians. I shudder. I hold my breath and listen. They are slowly approaching. The squeaking sounds like wheels turning on dry axles. I wake Vili Dochka carefully. He jumps up as usual and wants to say something. I just reach across to lay a hand over his mouth. Then we listen together. We assume that the Soviets have got their anti-tank guns or rocket launchers across the Vistula and are now moving them further forward. They are not being very quiet about it, and we reckon they have no idea that we're lying right here in front of them. If they get much closer, we might be able to surprise them by opening fire, and perhaps chase them away from their guns. We did this successfully once in Romania with two ATGs. Dochka removes the canvas cover from the machine gun, and I get in position behind the weapon. We wait and stare into the fog, but it looks as if they're not coming any closer. Then suddenly we hear other noises. The Russians are hacking and shoveling in the ground.
"Damn it. They are digging in their guns directly under our noses," says Dochka, annoyed. And then he adds, "What a mess. What should we do now?"
"Nothing for the moment," I answer nervously. "The fog's too thick. We don't even know for sure exactly where they are, and we can't just fire into the fog at random. But they can locate us quickly and can easily finish us off."
"Yeah, but we have to do something."
Dochka is excited and steps from one foot to the other.
"When they have dug themselves in, then God help us in the morning. At this range, they're going to spot us straight away."
"I know," I say, and feel how my thoughts about tomorrow morning drive my heart up into my throat. "It's obvious that we can't stay here," I say to Dochka. "The best thing would be for you to go back up to the young Oberleutnant and ask him where we should move to. Maybe he'll send down a strong force to surprise the Russians while they're digging." Dochka dashes out of the foxhole and runs up to the houses. Shortly afterwards he returns, and I can hear him cursing quietly. "What did he say?" I ask, expecting something bad.
"The bastard said we've got to stay put," Dochka spits out angrily.
"That can't be true. Did you tell him how close those guns are to us?" I ask incredulously.
"Of course. He said he already knows that the Russians are digging in their guns in front of us. We're to stay here until the tanks come."
"And exactly when are they supposed to be here?"
"He didn't say. But the Unteroffizier to our right rear is hopping mad as well. He reckons that the silly arse knows full well that no tanks are expected. They were assigned to another sector yesterday."
"Well then, we might as well write our last will and testament. Just how can an officer be so irresponsible? As soon as the fog lifts, they will be able to reach us with their shelling. Judging from the noise they're kicking up, the Russians must be close enough to chuck stones in our hole. We won't stand a chance if we stay in it. It's a death warrant. That's the way I feel right now. Who could be so idiotic as to let someone come here and give a stupid order that will decide whether we live or die? If this officer, whom I don't even know, didn't make this decision out of incompetence, then clearly he has decided to sacrifice us in the interests of his own safety." I mumble this last sentence to myself, but Dochka hears it and says with a grimace,
"I reckon that the idiot has his pants so full of crap that he thinks we can hold the Russians up long enough to allow him to escape.
We should upset this bloke's plans and go back to our first position, up there at the top of the field.
Are you mad, Dawker? I stop him in his tracks. This miserable fellow would sure as hell have us in front of a court-martial in no time. We can't do anything else but wait this one out and trust to luck.
I say this, although I know that our lives are now worth less than the straw we are standing on. I have been on the front long enough to be able to size up a situation correctly, and to know that belief in luck is a very weak subterfuge. Here only a prayer can help us. To ask God that he will be with us in this bitter hour of our wretched lives. Unlike me, Dawker is a Catholic. While I pray silently, he crosses himself and prays with trembling lips. He reminds me of Svina that time in Rychov. Svina was very religious, but even so, God had not preserved him. The fog becomes even thicker towards the morning. We are straining our eyes to see through the milky soup, and listening anxiously to the Russian commands and muffled calls which reach our ears. We've had a brief respite, but other than praying, there is nothing we can do. All the experience amassed during the war is not worth a tinker's cuss when you sit in a rat trap like this, from which there is no escape. Slowly, over the next hour, the fog begins to lift. First, the houses behind us come into view. Then the first rays of sunshine hit the stubble field. I look for the light machine gun position diagonally behind me, and recognize the sheaves of corn heaped around it. Somebody raises a hand and waves, and I wave back. I reckon the LMG will be brought in position first when it is needed. Until then, they can keep it hidden. Our HMG, on the other hand, must, because of its mounting, stand ready in position, all set to fire. We have lowered it and camouflaged it well with straw, but at this range and on this slope we can expect the enemy to see it immediately we open fire. And so it is. As the wind removes the last vestiges of fog in front of us, we are staring directly into the barrels of four guns. The range is about 100 meters. They must have discovered our positions, or else just fired first where the sheaves of corn are stacked up. As the muzzles flash, we feel the blast in our faces. That's how near they are. There is a sharp explosion, the sheaves are blown into the air, and our machine gun is now in the open.
"Anti-tank guns!" yells Dawker, thunderstruck, and crosses himself.
At the same moment, a second shell hits the mound and shatters the HMG to pieces. Dawker yells and clutches his throat. He looks dumbstruck at his bloody hand and presses it against his wound. Panic-stricken, he jumps out of the hole and runs up the field towards the village. Right behind him, another round explodes and rips off both his legs. His backside is thrown into the air and falls, covered in blood, onto the ground. Only seconds have passed, and as I again look towards the front, another flash comes from a gun barrel. The shell hits the mound in front of my position at full force and covers half my hole with dirt. I pull my legs out of the dirt and press myself tightly down onto it. Then the next round explodes immediately in front of me and sends a glowing splinter towards me. I feel a heavy impact on my upper right arm and some light splinters hitting my chest. Blood immediately starts running warm down my arm and dripping out of my sleeve. For a moment I am numb. Then I feel a burning sensation and pain.
"You will bleed to death here in this hole," I think, and then I am gripped with a terrible fear. "Just get away from here." The fright drives me out of my hole.
I press my left hand over my wound and dash away. Instinctively, I do not go the obvious way, up to the houses, but propelled by terror, I run to the right, towards the copse. I know that the direct fire gunners must first physically shift their aim in order to pick up a new one, in this case me. The shells start to land around me only after I have been running for a bit. They are firing at me as they would at a rabbit, so I behave like one, by constantly zigzagging. I carry on like this, to force the gunners to adjust their sights all the time. But I am running out of steam. My lungs are heaving like a pair of bellows, and I sense a light dizzy feeling. I can't stop the bleeding with my hand. The blood is running continuously out of my sleeve and is now soaking my trousers. Anti-tank shells are exploding to the right and to the left.
the dirt showering me in the face. Wheezing, I keep on running in zigzag fashion, running for dear life, afraid of being blown to bits by the next shell. But the trees in the wood are coming closer all the time, and then there are only a couple of paces left. Finally, I can hide from the enemy gunners. Their shells are exploding like mad in the trees, causing trunks and branches to snap like matchsticks. Well out of breath, I run further into the woodland, then fall to the ground. I am safe, but I'm not yet saved. I stand up again, but my knees are weak. The blood I have lost has weakened my body. But I must carry on. With my last ounce of strength, I run further through the wood, and under cover of the hill, back into the village. There are only 200 meters left to the edge of the village. My knees shaking, I reach the first houses. There are several vehicles between the houses, and two officers are watching the sloping ground down to the Vistula. The enemy's ATGs are now firing into the village, but they are receiving considerable counterfire from our heavy mortars. When the two officers see me, they wonder why I am coming from that particular direction. I explain to them where I was wounded, and that Obergefreiter Docker was killed. Neither the Major nor the Rittmeister knows there is a forward HMG position in the stubble field, thinking that the trenches at the edge of the village represent the most advanced line. They are surprised that I've managed to escape, bearing in mind my wounds, from the ATG fire. Then I collapse in a heap, and a driver just manages to catch me. The Major orders the driver of his VW Jeep to take me to the medics. Besides two medics, the Oberarzt of the battalion is there. He already knows me because he was the chap who sewed up my upper lip at the end of April. He greets me like an old pal and immediately cuts open my sleeve. "This time it got you pretty good," he says, as he lays open the large wound in my upper arm and sees the two smaller splinters in my chest. "The one in the arm seems to be a real big bastard, but as far as I can work out it didn't hurt the bone," he says. He attends to the wounds, and at the same time removes a small splinter from my chest, which had embedded itself under the skin. Then he bandages my arm tightly to my body and says in a fatherly way, "Now, off you go to the main collection station. They will find you a support brace, and then you are off home." Jokingly, he adds, "Including the scratches, this is your 6th wound, right? I'm sorry, but for your gold wound badge, there are still no diamonds like there are with the Knight's Cross." It is a while before the medic leaves, because 2 more wounded come in. I use the time to ask the medic to write a few words to Fritz Hamann, who is lying with his LMG somewhere in front of the village and will miss me before long. Now, with me falling out, Fritz is the last member of our troop of October 1943. I never saw him again throughout the war. 8th of August. At the main collection point, as the Oberarzt said, they fit me with a so-called Stukaverband, immobilizing my arm. The splinter has not been removed. It will be dealt with after it has been x-rayed at a military hospital back home, because it looks as if it has entered the bone. Only in the hospital train do I begin to realize that I've been lucky getting out of this mess. Though for how long? Anyway, I will first enjoy my stay in hospital. The wound does hurt, but what is that compared to the hell which lies behind me? The hospital train takes most of the wounded to Grottkau, a small village in Upper Silesia. There we are offloaded and taken to a spotlessly clean military hospital. Chapter 15. Vultures over Nemersdorf. August 30th. My hospital stay in Grottkau, which began on the 9th of August, was a period of convalescence for me. After the 5-centimeter-long splinter had been removed from my upper right arm, my wound healed up pretty quickly. Instead of the unpleasant Stuka cast, I can support my arm in a simple sling. In company with a wounded Feldwebel from an army AA unit, I explore the bars of the town and manage to get hold of something alcoholic instead of the usual whey beer. The rest of the time, I'm either playing cards or reading a book. While in hospital, I also get a visit from my mother, to whom I pass on the notes I've written since my last home leave, and have continued writing while on the front lines in Romania. Her gifts of tobacco and cigarettes come at a very convenient time for me as a heavy smoker, since our rations of these items are getting less and less. 4th of September. Today I am joining the convalescent company in Insterburg for the second time. Owing to the tense war situation, my convalescent leave has been cancelled. I can't feel anything at all from my wound. It's only a deep round scar, about double the size of the dial on my watch. I don't know anyone in the room in the convalescent barracks to which the orderly room had assigned me, but an Oberschnepser tells me that there are supposed to be some soldiers here from the 1st Schwadron of our regiment. I find some, but I don't know them. So many new men have passed through our unit recently. Many were with us for only a few days before they were killed or wounded. Some days later, to my enormous surprise, I meet someone in the grounds I had given up for dead. It's little Schroeder, who had got shot in the head by a Russian sniper in my foxhole on the 1st of January 1944, and whom both the medic and I had thought had no chance of survival. In spite of this, the medic had let him be taken off to the main medical station. Although his face is fuller and he has a scar the size of a dinner plate around his left ear, I recognized him immediately. It's a very happy reunion. Schroeder tells me that after he was wounded, he had woken up in the rear area hospital. His recovery had taken a long time, but his life had been saved. This is a miracle when you consider that a piece of his head almost the size of a fist, from his temple to his left ear, was shot away. Schroeder is now at another convalescent barracks, awaiting discharge. I spend many an hour with him before he is released. While we reminisce about the days at the Nikopol bridgehead, thoughts and images of Katia continually surface. We all had always considered her our guardian angel. We wonder whether she survived the arrival of the Russian troops. For Schroeder, the war is now over, but he has had to pay a big price for it. He will have many health problems for the rest of his life: partial deafness, irregular eyesight, and periods of dizziness. 8th of October. As well as Schroeder, I also by chance meet our Ober in the barracks. After his 7th injury, he was transferred to a training company, in which he is still serving. I can tell that he's also had it up to here, continuously being assigned to frontline duty. Although I had never aspired to becoming a leader, the Ober managed to get me assigned to his company as a recruit instructor. 9th of October. The rabble to be trained in our company consists of a mix of older East Europeans of German ethnic descent, most of whom were heads of families, and naval personnel, who, because of the shortage of ships for them to go to, are to be retrained to become tank infantry soldiers. Because of the undisciplined attitude of the sailors, many of whom had served in the Kriegsmarine for years, instructors who were highly decorated combat veterans were preferred, because these were the only people the sailors would respect. Even so, it was not always easy for us instructors to find the right tone of voice to use in order to get the message across to this group. 10th of October. The Russian front has moved a bit closer. The Soviets are said to be on the north bank of the river Memel. There is talk that our training company will be assigned to duty in Poland, at least in that part of it which is still free of Russians. 16th of October. The enemy is attacking with strong tank units and combat aircraft from Lithuania, and manages to create big salients in our front lines in many areas. Our barracks are placed on alert, and we receive fresh ammunition. It is still hard to believe that we will move from the simulated war games in the barracks to serious conflict. But reality has arrived. The enemy is about to invade and occupy our homeland. What a disgrace for the fighting troops. 21st of October. The Soviets are supposed to have penetrated to within 10 kilometers southwest of Gumbinen, and on the road west have reached the little city of Nemesdorf on the river Angerab. Everything in the barracks is thrown into confusion. Vehicles with officers in them dash back and forth, their commands echoing through the barracks grounds. Old trucks with wood-burning gas generators drive up to be loaded with new recruits not yet trained. These trucks have up till now only been used for supply and other basic training duties. We are now loaded onto these vehicles, and we have to squeeze down onto the floor amongst all the ammunition boxes and sacks of wood. After a short distance, the roads are getting so choked with refugees and their carts, horses and wagons that our column has to make wide detours through forests in order to reach the specified combat sector near Nemersdorf. We dismount during the afternoon and advance on Nemersdorf on both sides of the road. Surprisingly enough, there is no combat noise to be heard, but then further discussion is suddenly interrupted by enemy tank fire. The enemy is standing about 2 kilometers to our side and shooting on the street. Everyone immediately seeks cover in the ditch. Under cover of the darkness, we move nearer to the village and dig in on a small hillock. The Russians are reported to have taken over the trenches that in recent weeks were excavated by the Volkssturm and the local civilian population in order to defend the village. Our training company is going to storm these trenches with shouts of hurrah, we are told. The night passes quietly, but the recruits are nervous and can't get off to sleep. For them and the former sailors, it will be their first engagement. 22nd of October. A hazy fog covers the fields this morning, and the only view of the village is a few dim outlines of houses. Our company is located on the right flank and awaiting orders to attack. However, even before our orders arrive, the recruits from the other company are storming forward, yelling, "Hurrah!" They receive heavy machine gun and rifle fire in return. I can hear lots of voices calling out for medics. As we also start to attack, the counterfire is no longer as strong, but even so, we suffer 3 slightly wounded and 1 seriously wounded from my group. The losses from the other companies could be considerable. Together with some officers, it seems that a large number of NCOs and soldiers have been killed or wounded. The enemy suffers heavy casualties in the trenches. The rest try to get away, but they are captured one by one. We don't meet any more Soviets as we sweep through the village. Instead, we discover terrible incidents involving mangled bodies, reminding me of the atrocities committed by Soviet soldiers on their own villages, which I saw during our retreat in the spring of 1944. Here it is German women from whose bodies they have ripped clothing to shame and then mutilate them in the most inhuman manner. In a barn we come across an old man whose throat has been drilled through with a pitchfork so that his entire body is hanging on the barn door. In one house, all the feather cushions have been cut open and smeared with blood, and among the feathers lie the dissected bodies of 2 women and 2 murdered children. The sight is so terrible that some of our recruits run out in panic and vomit. It is impossible for me to describe all the terrible sights we have witnessed in Nemersdorf. I can't find the right words, and it is repugnant to have to talk about the horrific acts perpetrated on innocent women, children, and old people. For a moment I have to think back on what the recruit said when he saw ravens and crows, and so convincingly spoke about the buzzards being over Nemersdorf. Was it a coincidence that, at exactly that moment, such a large flock of birds was in the village? Or was there more to it? A premonition, perhaps? Unfortunately, I can't discuss this further with the young man in question, because he was the one who was badly wounded this morning during our assault. 23rd of October. After the battle for Nemersdorf, we learned that the local National Socialist Workers' Party office hadn't warned the population soon enough about evacuating the village. The people were therefore surprised in their sleep by the Soviets and couldn't escape. The party bigwigs, however, were all able to get away in time. 25th of October. By concentrating strong German units, the Soviet troops are again pressed back and the front lines once more stabilized. Our reserve battalion remains for a few more days to secure the Nemersdorf area and reoccupy the strong points and trenches. This morning we are relieved and return to the barracks in Insterburg. Over the course of the next few days there is a general disintegration of the Insterburg training area. The training companies are finally going to be deployed. 27th of October. Today we're leaving, but no one knows where we are off to. A number of rumours are flying about, one mentioning front-line duty, another further training and deployment in Poland. In the meantime, some of the ex-naval personnel have been detached and replaced by former Luftwaffe personnel. 29th of October. The uncertainty is laid to rest. We are offloaded in Lodz, Poland, and march, singing, through the gates of a Polish barracks, our home for the next few weeks. Chapter 16. From Poland to a Fool's Paradise. November the 10th. We have been in this former Polish barracks for almost 2 weeks. The place is built of red brick with a high wall all around. Heavy frost has arrived in the last few days, and we have been issued with warm overcoats. Each morning we sing along while we march with the training companies through the streets of Lodz towards the training ground outside the city. This area, which belongs to the barracks, is very large and is equipped with dugouts for protection against tanks. The training for the sailors and recruits is hard, but relatively pleasant. No one can complain about the food, only the tobacco rations fall short, and for heavy smokers like me, they are inadequate. It is therefore hardly surprising that some of the soldiers try to get in touch with the civilian population in order to get hold of Polish papieros cigarettes, the ones with the long filters, from the black market for resale to other soldiers. This trade was not without its risks, and in one unit a warning was given out that this type of contact had already got some men into trouble. Black market trading is illegal, so it takes place mostly in obscure or uncontrolled areas. However, German soldiers are often lured into these places by Polish underground personnel for the express purpose of being murdered. Virtually every day we hear about soldiers who had been found dead or have just disappeared without a trace. In our barracks building there have been 2 incidents in which recruits disappeared and were never found. According to statements from their colleagues, they hadn't deserted. 7th of January 1945. There is an air of breaking up within the barracks once more, and we are driven to the railway goods station and loaded onto a train. We're not told where we're going, and the rumours are flying. All sorts of theories are put forward, although we as instructors know from the battalion commander that we will not be dispatched to the front as training has not yet been completed. We travel generally at night, and because of the continuous bombing raids on the cities, we only stop when we're in open countryside. Our journey takes us through Berlin and Hamburg and further north to Denmark. When we reach Aarhus, we're offloaded and driven from there to a small village. 10th of January to the 6th of March. Our training company is billeted in a newly built school near the port of Aarhus. We are very well accommodated and have enough space in which to carry out our training and weapons instruction. Outside it is freezing cold, and a light dusting of snow covers the fields. The garrison is well placed for training the recruits, as it's only a few minutes to the range for gunnery practice. After our first look round the village, it's rather like being in paradise, because we're able to buy a lot of things which we've had to do without for a long time. We have taken a particular fancy to the cakes and cream puffs available from all the bakers' shops. I don't think I will ever again eat as many cream puffs as I have pushed down my gullet these last few days. Our stay here in Denmark has started off really nicely, but then a series of unexpected, loathsome and provocative acts become the routine, and for me and some of the others, finally an unbearable torment. The reason for all this is the new company commander, who doesn't know enough about combat training and leadership. We got a sample of this the day we arrived. Because, in his opinion, our company had not dressed ranks properly when the Transportführer reported to him, he made us stand in the freezing cold in front of the school for an hour. Only then did he accept the Transportführer's report and dismiss us. This was a pretty selfish demonstration of his authority. He made himself look ridiculous. He was a comical-looking Leutnant who belonged to the old spit-and-polish brigade, and who recently, mainly out of pity, had been promoted from Stabsfeldwebel to officer rank. In his case, the compassion was probably well directed, because he had at some time unfortunately lost his left arm and been injured in one eye, which had gained him a silver wounded badge and the Iron Cross second class. The loss of his left arm in no way prevented him from using his right arm in the manner of a jumped-up drill sergeant. Neither did it stop him constantly patting us in order to correct our body posture as we were submitting our combat reports in front of the recruits. To show us up in this way was bad form,
coming from a superior in the presence of recruits, to whom it must also have appeared pretty silly. As a result of his constant nagging and touching of the instructors and recruits, correcting a shoulder which might sag a half centimetre, or correcting a salute because the raised arm did not reach above the eyebrow,